Tolerance in Islam. This panel is being brought to you through a grant of the Fulbright program. And this program is called Direct Access to the Muslim World. And the purpose of this program is to inform American citizens and university students and community members and church groups about Islamic religion and culture. And we are very privileged to have with us our visiting Fulbright scholar from Turkey, Dr. Hadija Simten Joshar, who will be presenting. The presentation will be moderated by Dr. Ora Said, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northern Michigan University. And, of course, our very own Dr. Moe Moafi, who is a professor of nutrition in our own Hyper department. Let me mention one other thing about our visiting scholar, and that is that she is an associate professor of political science and international relations at the at Bashkent University in Ankara, Turkey. I believe Dr. Said has some additional introductions, and so I will leave you with our panel moderator, Dr. Ora Said, and thank you for coming.
There, a handheld microphone somewhere. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you to this panel on discussion on, as it is titled, Reform Currents in Islam. I'll talk a little bit about the title here in a minute. But I'm very happy to see a genuine crowd. By that, I mean it's not just one age group or one type. It's mixed, and there's community people I recognize here, and there are students, and there are the faculty of NMU, and I welcome you all here, and I hope we can have a good interaction with our two panelists. I am Ora Said. I'll be the moderator for this panel. And I personally would like to welcome President Dr. Les Wong, who is with us here. He's been at the forefront of internationalization of NMU, which is exactly where we ought to go, the way the world is, and the way it is shaping up. So I'm very happy to see Les here amongst us. It encourages us, and it also kinds of sends a message regarding our internationalization, the importance of our internationalization efforts. I am sure he will continue to support these efforts, which are kind of, it seems to me, his hegemonic project in NMU. That is the big thing there. Now let me welcome our panelists. First and foremost, Dr. Hadija Joshar, who's traveled from Turkey on a Fulbright exchange, a visiting scholar program. She's with us. She is, Dr. Borgo just mentioned, she is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Bashkent University in Turkey. She got her PhD from Bilkent University in Ankara in Turkey, and her dissertation title was The State and Intellectual in Turkey, From Liberal Ethos to the Myth of Democracy. Very intriguing dissertation indeed. And as Dr. Joshar has numerous publications to her name in journals at different places in Turkey and also internationally. She's And just scanning through her publications, one can judge the focus of her research and her and the problematic that she is dealing with. It's the same as the rest of us are dealing with today as the world globalizes, and especially in relationship to the Muslim world, which, as most of you, I'm sure, know, is all around the world. So with a quarter of the population, almost a quarter of the population of the globe, with the land area, which is from the Atlantic to the Pacific, a huge chunk of our humanity. And a civilization which, as some say, is a genuine contribution to the development of human civilization in all areas. There are numerous issues that plague this region and the world, including our region, regarding the Islamic world. It is really a great honor to welcome Dr. Joshar. Our second panelist is, as Louis said, our very own. And I call him living, walking NMU. I'm speaking of Dr. Moafi. Dr. Moafi has been with NMU for 31 years. That is more than a lifespan. Not yours, but I mean, it just makes me think, like, that's all life is, you know, the 31 years you got between when you grow up till you are, you know, sent to the hospice or something. Don't want to be scary, but, you know, it's a lifetime of contribution to Northern Michigan University. Though Dr. Moafi teaches nutrition with Hyper, but he has been deeply interested in these same questions of change in the Islamic world, its direction, its difficulties, and its possibilities, which is very good because we do need interdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary, in this case, efforts to it is everybody's. This is important. Ought to be important to everybody. So I see a mathematician here. So, you know, others are. That's the important thing. And so, welcome, Dr. Moafi. I'm sure we will learn a lot from you regarding your topic. Just briefly, let me. I'll give you a head up on the sort of the roadmap on how this panel is going to go. I'm going to first invite Dr. Joshar, and she will discuss with us, and she'll present on women in Islam, which is a generic discussion as a thing about relating religion and Islamic politics and the role of women. Then she'll move on to discuss Islam and its role in Turkey, historically and in the contemporary times. And Dr. Joshar is been focused on gender issues within Turkey as well as, generally speaking, within the Islamic discourse. She will then talk to us about Muslim religious activists in Turkey, women activists in Turkey, and she will then provide us with details on a case which I know nothing about, the Bashkent Kadın Platformu, which is Bashkent Women's Platform. She'll move from an abstract level discussion on women in Islam to a very concrete level, current day actual activists who are giving direction to Turkish society and politics. I would imagine she'd be able to do this within 25 minutes. You know, it's a lifetime's work in 25 minutes or maybe half an hour. I think, okay. And Dr. Mwamfi is going to focus on something here, something in the Western world, with the title Islam at a Crossroad. He just handed me something. He will, however, as we discussed earlier, he would be focusing on this whole thesis on the clash of civilizations that came up, of course, Samuel Huntington. Huntington's thesis on clash of civilizations, which has jarred a lot of scholars and people, and really caused furor in all parts of the world. Dr. Mwafi will explain to us, and if I were to use a scholar whom I deeply respect, who is posthumous now, Dr. Edward Said, that he termed this clash of ignorance. And I think there was value in just turning the words around. Sometimes you can make sense just by turning the words. So Dr. Mwafi will focus on issues related to the discussion and the discourse on clash of civilizations and the implications and what options we may have to actually deal with such a clash or perpetrated clash. So I'm sure all of us are looking forward to hearing from the panelists. There's one last point I want to make, which is about the title of the topic. The current title is Reform Currents in Islam. Certainly that is okay. But if one goes a little bit deeper, I would prefer the title to be understood as. His title is fine, but I would prefer that we understand the title as Reform Currents in Muslim Societies. Because when we think of Islam, we are really talking about the religion, the theology, and which is a sacred religion like other religions are sacred to their believers. We are not here to be new Martin Luther's or to be new prophets. We are not re-engineering Islam at all. I think that remains a historical thing. So our focus is actually on the how Muslim societies are changing and the possibilities of change and the hurdles and so on, the dimensions, etc. I just wanted to clarify that because this, I think, is an important thing to clarify. With this, let me welcome Dr. Joshar. She will now, you can check if your mic works.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. I can come there too, but you know, whatever
as you like.
Prefer. I mean,
as you prefer.
It's okay with me sitting here. Okay. Well, in fact, before the panel started, before the introduction started, we were here talking a little bit with Dr. Syed and Dr. Mwafi, and about my first name, that is Hatija, that is the name of the wife of Prophet Muhammad. In fact, the name of my grandmother, again, you know, this is the kind of a tradition. Is it echoing? No? Is it okay? Yeah. Yeah. It would be better. No, it's better than that. So 2 minutes, huh? I have 2 minutes more. Okay, thank you. Should I start from the beginning? Yes. Before the panel with Dr. Syed and Dr. Mwafi, we were talking about my first name, that is Hatija. And it's the name of the wife of the Prophet Muhammad. and the name of my grandmother, in fact. And in my society, it is a tradition, it's an established tradition for the fathers to give the name of their mothers to their daughters. So first name is Hatice, the second one is the name that my father wanted me to have. The first one is Arabic, the other one is Persian, in fact. But I'm Turkish, that's another thing. This is besides the point. Dr. Syed and Dr. Mowafi told me that, in fact, Hatice can be taken as a role model concerning the women's rights issue in Islam because she was older than Prophet Muhammad, almost 20 years or something, I guess 18 years, but I'm not sure about it. And she kind of encouraged him to tell the people to spread the word to the Muslim, not then Muslim, non-Muslim societies about Islam, that God connected with him, that he got the saying of God. Yes, but when I look at Islam as a feminist, in fact, I stop there because I do not see that much kind of a women's rights in Islam. And most of the people who in Turkey today claim to be Muslims and who perceive Islam in a certain way, most of them are women, and who want both women's rights and also live a life as devout Muslims in their own way. Try to combine these two issues, these two standings, that is the women's rights, defending women's rights on the one hand and being devout Muslims on the other hand, try to do this in a rather difficult, under rather difficult conditions. They face difficulties because they see that Islam for centuries has been interpreted by men. Ijtihad, that is the interpretation that forms the basis of Islamic jurisprudence in Muslim societies, and especially dominant in those societies which are ruled under Sharia law. Islamic jurisprudence, on the other hand, is based on the interpretation mainly by males, by men. So they look at history, Islamic history. They see a lot of women active in Islam, in the spread of Islam, but they also see that they are not dominant. They do not have the means to interpret Islam, to interpret religion in their own terms. That is with a women's gaze. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. And especially I will focus on those women who organized, those Muslim women who organized on the basis of women's rights advocacy and who tried to kind of form a synthesis between being feminist on the one hand and also devout Muslims on the other hand. They have really difficult job to do. That's one thing. That's for sure. We should, you know, kind of give them their rights. This is not only the case in Turkey, in fact. You can find a lot of brilliant, courageous, active women rights defenders in Iran, for example. You can find them in Sudan. You can find them in Egypt. You can find them. In fact, Egypt is really famous with their women's rights defenders and feminists. And who struggle, this is the hard job, who struggle both to be devout religious people and also feminists on the other end. Because when there is patriarchy in a society, when it is normalized, it's really hard to make people change their ideas about the established relation between men and women, about the established understanding of women in the society. And this is nothing specific to Islam. Everybody knows this, you know. This is nothing specific to religion, and this is nothing specific to Islam. But our topic is Islam today. Now, depending on one of the most famous Muslim feminists, Fatima Mernissi, who had done for decades of research, going through the original text, trying to understand what went wrong in Islam, that the practice turned out to be to the disadvantage of women, and trying to offer a reading of Quran and Islam with a woman's gaze, what we can see in Islam is a contradictory stance regarding women, vis-a-vis women. On the one hand, you see the portrayal of a woman, woman at large, in fact, it is a category there, so there might not be that much difference among different women. You see the portrayal of women as active subjects. That's important. So they are capable to do a lot of things, you know. They are intelligent. They are so intelligent that they can be dangerous towards men, for men. So they can deceive them. They can lead them to sins. On the other hand, you see, again, I'm talking about jurisprudence. That's important. That is the patriarchal reading of, according to Manisi, of course, patriarchal reading of Quran and Hadith, that is the sayings of Muhammad and Sunnet, that is his practices. When Manisi and the likes look at Islam with such a woman's gaze, what they see is that the woman is both perceived as an active subject plus an object that should be suppressed. And when they look at the practices that follow the death of Muhammad, especially, what they see is this suppression. So they should be veiled, for example, not every time, since veiling is not a condition that is stated in Quran, since veiling is something totally different, in fact, they sometimes deserve to be treated badly if they happen to fall out of the orders of Quran and their husbands or their fathers, that is the patriarchs. And, you know, Manisi and the likes try to understand why this has to be that way. Why this has to be that way, which would lead someone, a Muslim woman, to ask for her rights, in order to ask for her rights, to leave her religion or to have a distance with her religion. So they want to find a middle way. They want to find a middle way. And the way that they found is really hard. They are rereading Quran and Islam. That's the hardest point of it. In Turkey, there are such women. You know, there's this Başkent Kadın platform that Dr. Sayed has mentioned about. It's nothing to do with my university. My university's name is Başkent University. This is the Başkent Kadın platform. This coincidence is because Ankara is the capital city of Turkey, and Başkent means in Turkish capital. So my university's name is to do with it, and this platform's name is to do with it. These are women mainly opting for helping the other women who are mainly Muslim, who are devout Muslims. I'm going to talk about what they understand by being devout Muslims. Forming cooperation among Muslim women, regardless of what the male patriarchy, regardless of what patriarchy imposes on them. They were founded in 1995. And they, you know, their activities range from struggling for the right to veil themselves, that's important, the right to veil, that is the right to cover their heads and bodies according to a certain Islamic standard. It ranges from that right to the right to dig into the feminist literature, international feminist literature, not the feminist literature only in Turkey, but throughout the world, and to form cooperation at a global level with other women's rights organizations, be them Muslim or not. So, you know, this organization, it's an association, works at a multidimensional platform from local to national and then to the global scale. These are really bright women. They are almost all of them are, you know, the leaders, the ones that are the founders of the platform. Almost all of them are university graduates. They have their own jobs. They work outside. They step outside the domestic sphere. They are not suppressed at all, as is the prejudice goes, you know, as is the stereotype goes. They are not suppressed. They have their relations with their partners and husbands are, in fact, you know, founded at a certain equality principles. I did research with them. I conducted in-depth interviews with them. And, you know, my research did not stop at the interview level. In fact, they changed my worldview at a certain point about being both feminist and also devout, I'm going to describe it, devout Muslims, you know, asking for the right to wail oneself on the one hand, asking for other women's rights. So they kind of helped me to kind of also destroy my own prejudices. But before that, I should give a brief summary of what secularism means in Turkey, what is it like to be a Muslim in Turkey, what is the relation between Islam and politics in Turkey? Because without that knowledge, it's hard to understand these women, and it's hard to understand the importance of Başkent Kadın platform, Başkent Women's platform. I have time, I guess. Okay. Now, Turkey's relation with Islam is a little bit contradictory again, is a little bit complex. You know, it's known as a Muslim country. It's included in the Muslim world. It has a secular state. It has a secular political institutionalization. It's heir to Ottoman Empire. That's one thing. It is among the two countries which was never colonized. In fact, in the Muslim world, let me put it in that way. In the Middle East, I can say it also in that way too. It's a republic. The republic is formed out of the ashes, that's the cliche goes, out of the ashes of Ottoman Empire in 1923, after First World War. After First World War, Ottoman Empire was partitioned, and from within the Ottoman Empire, we see some mainly military people forming their own networks, forming their own army, and then on moving to form their own central governments, and at the same time fighting, getting into war. So, you know, it got out of the nation state in Turkey, the republic in Turkey, got out of this First World War. In 1923, the republic was proclaimed. Before that, but in 1922, we see the abolition of Sultanate. Ottoman Empire was totally destroyed. And then in 1924, we see the abolition of Caliphate. You know, the Caliph was Ottoman up to that time. So we see bit by bit the erasing of the institutional importance of Islam in Turkey. And when the Republic was founded, and after the foundation of the Republic, for about 10 or 15 years, there was this intense struggle on the part of the founding elite, led by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. I think many of you have heard about him. Led by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and then on Republican People's Party. That is the first single party of Republican period. The ruling elite tried to erase the meaning of Islam from the political sphere. In doing so, they also tried to transform society from above. That's an important point. So, up to that time, we see in Ottoman times an empire based on Islam, but not only ruled by Sharia, also ruled by what is called in English or fiqh hukuk common law. That is the deeds and sayings of Sultan himself, apart from his caliphate identity. And we see that empire ruling a multi-ethnic community. This means that we see Ottoman rulers ruling over territories populated by different ethnically and religiously organized communities. But after the Republic, what we see is the rise of a nation state. So first we see an effort to create an homogeneous national identity that would be represented by the state itself. And we see the erasing of Sharia law, From the legal system, we see political institutions built not on religion but on national identity plus what is called in Turkey the project of modernization. For a long time, it was known as project of westernization, identified with it. And we see the ruling elite trying to reflect these changes at the institutional level to the societal level. That's the important thing. But the society was there. The society was basically Muslim. Due to the partition of the Ottoman Empire, the territory that is now called Turkey was mainly populated by Muslim people. We see them. We see that they are stubborn in continuing their religious daily practices, which extends from fulfilling the five pillars of Islam regularly, not only in private sphere but also in public sphere, to talking in Arabic or Ottoman or Persian, to dress codes. That's an important thing. And one by one, in really a short period of time, we see the ruling elite, for example, kind of imposing certain reforms, like the head law in 1925, for example, making the wearing of fez, you might know it, that is the classical Ottoman and also Arabic hat, illegal, and instead pushing the people to wear every day the hat, Western-style hat. But nowhere we see a dress code regarding women. That's important. There's, you know, this is a legal thing. You know, there's this dress code legally binding, and it still exists, but not every man wears hat, Western-style hat. It's a kind of a fashion now. But at those times, it was obligatory for Turkish people living on the territories of Turkey or Turkish Republic to wear hat after 1925. So they were also punished because of not kind of obeying this law. This could be this can be understood within the project of modernization. As far as women go, we do not see a dress code, but we see insistent emphasis on women in order to convince them that wearing is not something good. It means the suppression of women's identity. So the ruling elite were, in fact, talking from within the feminist literature. That is why, at those years, we witness what many Turkish women scholars and also Turkish feminists called the state feminism. You know, Turkish women got a lot of political rights, rights to education in the early years of the republic. So, you know, they were provided with Western style of women's rights. But at the same time, their style of dressing, their style of acting were also coded with a view to the construction of a Turkish nation state and plus modernization. That was devised by the ruling elite. The hottest debate that began regarding the women issue in Turkey with respect to religion were made in those days, and then they stopped. In those days, meaning up to 1940s or something, and then they stopped. Then they restarted in post-1980 period. Up to 1981, we do not see any restriction legally coded, that's important, not only in discourse, legally coded regarding the way women dress in Turkey. But in 1981, we see a code restricting the woman from wearing in the public sphere, which turned out to be a ban on women who wear to take university education. This is the most famous part of the debate going on still in contemporary Turkey. Then in 1995, we see the reenactment of the code. Because in the meantime, there were certain amendments to the code, and women veiled women, or women who cover their heads in a certain style, could get education for some years, and then on it was left to the universities to accept those women or not. Some universities accepted them for education, some did not, and after 1995, it was not left to the universities, the state totally banned. Today, it's still the hottest topic as far as Muslim women are concerned in Turkey. Başkent Kadın Platformu works in that way too. It works in that way too. It, in fact, kind of tries to get the right of women to decide what to wear on themselves, not only by religion or, no, by religion, of course, not only by males who kind of interpret religion, but also by the state itself. So they say that we want to choose it, to will or to unwill. So this is a, you know, kind of a summary regarding the Turkish case with Islam. Of course, Turkey's experience with Islam is really, really complex and cannot be kind of squeezed into just 10 minutes or 5 minutes, but this is the aspect of it that is related to my presentation here. Let me just give you some technical details about Başkent Kadın Platformu, Başkent Women's Platform, sorry. It was founded in 1995. It is an association which is not hierarchically organized. That is, there is no ruling mechanism. There is no president, for example. There is no head. There is no representative of the platform. You know, you can talk anybody with anybody in the platform, and they, interesting, they say almost the same things, you know, or similar things regarding their stances, both in terms of secularism, in terms of religion, and so on and so forth. There's this technical administrative head, and it changes in 2 years' time. So there's this compulsory obligation, in fact, for the administrative head to resign from the head, being the head of the platform. Well, its aim is stated as bringing together religious women, not men. That's important. They do not accept male members. Bringing together religious women together and kind of educating these women for cooperative action in the name of women's rights advocacy. It turns out that both from the things that they say, both from the documents that they publish, the works that they publish, and both from my interviews that I made with them for a couple of times, it turns out that they're open to dialogue. They are really open to dialogue. They can even question unveiling or veiling. They can, you know, there are some members, I did these interviews periodically, but for example, 2 years ago, I interviewed a couple of, with 7 members, and one of them was veiled at that time. You don't have to be veiled, by the way. You don't have to cover your heads in order to be a part of this platform, but most of them are veiled. Most of them cover their heads. One of them were veiled, and now I know that she doesn't veil herself anymore. So they're open to any kind of evolution, but mainly open to dialogue. That's the most important thing, and that's one of the legs that can be found in contemporary Turkish women's movement, especially among the Republican women. Though they are trying to come over this problem, you know, you can see that these women are more open to dialogue. They just want to try to understand the world. They publish documents and books which reread Quran from a woman's gaze. That's the most important thing they do. Thus, they are not liked by the authorities. You might know that neither the Islamic ones nor the ones that they rule Turkey right now. You know, you might know that Turkey is right now ruled by a government which used to be a pro-Islamic government, but which turned out to be a conservative democratic one. So its roots lie back in the Islamist movement, legal Islamist movement, but right now they term themselves as conservative Democrats, and this has been going on for about 5 years. In November, it's going to be 5 years, so we're going to have the elections. So since 2002, we are ruled by this government, and they are the naughty girls. They call themselves as the naughty girls of power because they voted for AKP. That is the government that rules us now. So because they voted for AKP because they thought that they are Muslims. I mean, they would work for their own causes. So, for example, for kind of lifting up the ban on veiling in the public sphere. That's one thing. They are basically struggling to lift that ban up. In Turkey, you know, there's this discussion right now going on among both official circles and also academic circles regarding the definition of public sphere. Since veiling is banned in the public sphere, people try to sort out what kind of a thing public sphere can be. You know, it is university, that's for sure, but what about the government? It is government, that's for sure too. What about the hospitals? If I'm a veiled woman, can I work in the hospital? Or if I'm a veiled woman, can I go to the hospital to search for, you know, service, to ask for service and help? You know, all this debate is going on, and Başkent Kadın Platform is kind of contributing to this debate in a really, really constructive fashion. Well, they are not that much big in number. They have 100 to 300 members. Not all the members pay dues, so this is mostly a voluntarily run organization. They are not that much involved in projects. That's another thing. So, you know, their place is like a home, and it is a home of one of the members, in fact, and they try to kind of do their activities in such a fashion. But this is Başkent Kadın Platform. There are other Muslim women activists in Turkey, too. You know, there is this, how can I translate it? There is this Gökkuşağı Rainbow Women's Platform, comprised of, for example, Başkent, the one that I talk about, Hazar, Akder, and Hekva. One of these organizations that I cited, one of these four organizations, that is Akder, was mainly founded in 1997 with the aim to struggle against the ban on veiling in university campuses. That's it. You know, the students were formed it, the students who were kind of dismissed from school because they rejected to the women students, of course. They rejected to uncover their heads, and they founded it, and they are struggling for it. The other ones are mainly, except for Başkent, are mainly charity organizations. They help the poor, but they are distinguished from other charity organizations by being devout Muslims. In these women's world, being devout means fulfilling the five pillars of Islam that I talked about, in fact. That is shahadat, in fact. It's shahada, huh? In English, shahada, that is namaz, that is praying five times a day on a regular basis. That is zakat, helping the poor. That is hajj, going to be a pilgrimage. That is fasting. Sorry, in the Ramadan time. For these women, we add one more, veiling your head. Though, not always, because they give you the option of uncovering your head. That's one thing. That's the most important thing about Başkent Kadın Platformu, in fact. They give you the space for unveiling, and they don't let you out. You're still there. But, you know, veiling, since it's not found in Quran or classical age of Islam, in the same way as it's practiced today, is still a contentious issue in our approach to them also, in trying to kind of establish them as solid identities. I mean, this is something but so familiar, isn't it? You cannot just name the people in our age, in the contemporary age, that easily. You cannot locate them that easily. I think I'm okay with this. I think I said all the things that I want to say, but I'm open to questions later on. Okay. Thank you for being patient.
We really did not coordinate this, so some things may fit and some things may not. But the most important thing that I really want to start with is to remind you that Muslims are incredibly, hugely diverse population. That probably the biggest mistake to make is to think that once you've seen one, you've seen them all. I mean, here are three Muslims here, and I think we look different. At least I know I look more handsome than you. Okay. I would like to tell you first what I think of myself, and that could really explain a lot of at least what my paradigm is about. I am an Egyptian-born American Muslim, deliberately in that order. I am not a mouthpiece for the religion, nor do I claim that to be a scholar. In fact, I just found a scholar sitting back there. Good to see you, Keith. But I have my views, and I'll be damned if I didn't share them. So this is a page from the Quran. It's the very first page, and it's called the Fatha, or the opening. And unfortunately, it's not translated in English. In fact, the only English copy of the Quran that I have is a gift to me from my friend Aaron Schoenick, who is Jewish, which in itself, I believe, speaks volumes. But if you read the first page, the Fatha, you would find it impossible to imagine any act of unkindness or violence after that. Because the very first words, actually, is, in the name of God, Allah is God, most merciful, most compassionate. And then it goes on. However, and I want to set our mindset a little bit here. It doesn't really need any intelligence, even, to realize that in the last, I would say even 100 years, there has been progressive increase in violent act and violent mentality. And it becomes more and more widespread because of some events that had really nothing to do with the with the beginning of that. The danger I see is not really only in the increase in the violent mentality or even the violent action. The real danger that I see is that there is warm, friendly water for the militant to swim in. That is more dangerous. There is a culture that would allow for almost, you know, mutations. And also, again, confined more or less on the Arab region. I also would like to make my own observation, it may be true, and that one of the differences that I see between Muslims is where they are from. Muslims of desert origin are really different from Muslims from Europe, from Muslims from non-desert areas, and the harshest of all, you will always find to be those of a desert origin. Perhaps the harshness of the environment has something to do with that, perhaps not. This is a picture of a stew. And the reason I'm putting a stew here is about 3 years ago or so, Fred was sponsoring a forum. And what I did is to add all of what I thought of as factors contributing to the mess. And because maybe I love cooking and I love food and I teach nutrition, so I made it into a stew. And every one of these factors really was an ingredient in that stew. So I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. That's like about 48 pages, really. But there is one little paragraph from that presentation that I would like to read it to you because, I mean, I like all of the paragraphs, but this one really means an awful lot to me. And if you can read it in the screen, great, but I would read it along with you, not dramatically or anything. But over the last few decades, many Islamic societies were subjected to various types of despots who ruled with an iron fist. I was born in Egypt. I know what being ruled with an iron fist is. Even though, luckily, my family really was never exposed to that iron fist. But I know what iron fist is. I know what it means for somebody to have people knock on their door at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they leave to be questioned, and they never come back. It's pure as that, as simple as that. So this alone, I think, led to actually should have been a predictable spiral downfall, because oppression kills social mobility. And the absence of social mobility leads to a widespread lack of competence. And a lack of competence results in a collapse of institutions, and I mean all institutions. And that alone can generate feelings of despair and outrage and anger, which was the genesis of having that violent mentality. And then it begins to permeate. I'm not sure how many of you read The Tipping Point, but not that I really like the book, but I think Liz, you did not like the book either. But there is a point in there that he makes, is it's almost like when a virus needs to spread, there are three things that have to be simultaneously present for a virus to spread. And all of the reasons for a virus to spread were there. The virus itself, the kind of like the ability of the virus to mutate, to adapt to whatever it is, and a very fertile ground for it to grow, particularly the nice, friendly, warm water, as Tom Friedman refers to it, that the militants have their own friendly water to swim in. There is a catch-22 that really is very perplexing, and to me, it is probably one of the major reasons for the problem. When we invaded Iraq, and one of the reasons, when the first reason did not work out, the second reason was we are spreading democracy in the Middle East. In fact, I'm not really sure how many of you remember a document at that time that was called the Greater Middle East. And in some cases, when democracy started to appear, if you are, and I really do not mean to be insulting at all, but if you are limited in your imagination of democracy, that it stops at a purple painted finger that I have voted. Well, that is great, but that is not democracy. You are light years from getting there. However, every time voting was available, guess who won? You know, I mean, there are a lot of examples to share, okay? When there was democratic elections in Gaza, Hamas won. When there was, if ever there will be democratic elections in Egypt, although it is quasi-democratic, I bet you anything, the Muslim Brothers would have a much larger presence in the Egyptian parliament. Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily, but the way things are now, when these people win and they become the saviors, I don't really think it is good for the whole. It is good for some, for a few, but it's not for the whole. So maybe spreading democracy, for how absolutely wonderful it sounds, is not a good idea. I'm asking questions. I'm not giving answers. There are many faces in the room. I know you are in my classes. You end up with more questions than we should sort it. I'm not an answer kind of guy, okay? If we attempt to solve this, if we attempt to solve the spreading of very militant, strident, almost messianic type of mentality, we end up with another catch-22, and that is the cracking down. This is a woman, an Egyptian woman, and behind her, I'm not really sure whether you can see or not, this was a street riot when there was 120 empty coffins. And the 120 empty coffins were 120 people that died in torture. Well, some people say, well, you know, if you're going to be causing society harm, you had it coming. But the thing is, I'm not really sure how many of you saw the movie Casablanca. You should. But remember the line, round up the usual suspects? So anytime something happens, you round up the usual suspects. And some of these usual suspects, day after day, in, you know, being exposed to some of the absolutely most barbaric, brutal type of questioning, if you will, sometimes it is to get information, although I don't really think that this is the best way to get information. My father was a prosecutor before he became a Supreme Court justice, and he never allowed interrogation to be even touching the person, that you can intellectually get something out. And sometimes it is to scare others. I mean, if you're sent to your home minus a nose, I think a lot of people are going to be afraid to do something. Or sometimes it's a feud. It's a family feud. And it is a feud between the secret police or the national security or whatever and the militants. Kind of like the Chicago way. You kill one of us, we'll kill 10 of you. And it goes on. It never stops. Okay? So that is one of the catch-22. In fact, Ayman Zawahiri, who is the brain for Al-Qaeda. Don't think that Osama bin Laden really is. Osama bin Laden wrote some checks, okay? I'm not saying he's a great guy, but the brain is Ayman Zawahiri, and Ayman Zawahiri was the leader of the cell that assassinated Sadat. Ayman Zawahiri spent about 8 years in Egyptian prisons until the Saudis bought him, basically, and said, we'll send him to Afghanistan, and you will never hear from him again. And we did. But Ayman Zawahiri was kind of like on a torture schedule that, you know, daily, basically. So that's one catch-22. For us to understand the complexity of fear, I have some prerequisites that I have a feeling you all have it. But just in case, I want to remind you of it. Number one, there is nothing in the Middle East that is black or white. As a matter of fact, I think, again, if you are in my classes, I can hardly find anything in life that is black and white. If you do not know how to think in gray, you're going to be intellectually paralyzed when you're there, okay? Number two, that we need certain ingredients. One of them is cerebral fitness, okay? This is what F. Scott Fitzgerald defined as the ability to hold two opposing thoughts simultaneously and still function, that you're not paralyzed by two opposing thoughts. You have to have that ability. Emotional fitness, okay? You may be feeling really lousy about having to do something, but if it is the something that needs to be done, it needs to be done. Feelings will change. Les is a psychologist. He can tell us that. Feelings come only from thoughts. That's why there is something called cognitive behavior therapy, okay? So I'm not really worried much about the feeling, because they will change. And then spiritual fitness. And for now, I'm just going to limit it to a verse from the Quran. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ أَمَنُوا لَكُمْ دِينَكُمْ وَلِيَ دِينَ. You have your faith, I have mine, and that's where it stops. That's spiritual fitness to me. You want to call it religious tolerance, fine. I mean, anything. In any term you put on it. But it really is spiritual fitness. And if you do not have that, you're not fit. You need to go to spiritual gym or something. Okay? Again, something that really bothers a lot of non-Middle Eastern or non-Arabs, okay, is knowing that the shortest point between two the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Well, not in the Middle East. It's not. You have to go through so many different, you know, try different things out, zigzag some things, detour some things, and then you get to the other point. Okay, and I'm not saying that one is better than the other. One is more frustrating than the other, maybe. If you don't have any of those, it's going to be very difficult, really, to stay with me the rest of the presentation, because what I'm asking you is to have a paradigm shift. And when I teach something about paradigm shift, 5 minutes already, and I'm on my second slide. I forgot 28. All right. A paradigm shift is, look at this guy, okay, with all of the comfort of hanging in this thing and absolutely nothing inside to hang on, and then you are requested actually to let go of this, okay? That takes courage. That takes an enormous amount of courage. Do we have a mess? Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Okay? And although this mess has been kind of like brewing for about 60 or 50 or 60 years, I really would like to challenge anyone who says that this is a clash of civilizations. It really is not. As a matter of fact, one of the strongest reformers, an Egyptian woman by the name of Wafa Sultan, who lives in Los Angeles, said, to have a clash of civilizations, you have to have civilizations. Okay? Where are they? Is it a clash of between religions? I really do not think so. I mean, I have a feeling none of you sitting in the room here is plotting the demise of a faith that is not yours. So I don't really think it is that either. Is it a clash of cultures? Do you know how many cultures there are on the globe? They're not clashing. So I don't really buy that either. Is it a clash of states of development? And if you read the United Nations Development Report, particularly the United Nations Arab Development Report, it's very humiliating. I mean, to put it very mildly, it's a very, very embarrassing thing. But there are people who are even less developed, and we do not have the same clash with them. That's 1 minute out of the five. So I want to just show you these questions, and maybe I will get to the rest directly. Is Islam really a religion of peace? The answer is yes. But it is with a qualified but. There are two chapters in the Quran, okay, the Tawbah and the Anfal, they do contain verses that are purely violent, okay? Now, you need to remember that these two chapters were during the times where Muslims had to literally fight for their life. They were completely outnumbered. These were the pep talks to rally the troops. This is like why I say if you are a football coach and your team is going to play and you do not say, be gentle, touch him lightly, excuse me, all right? So that is, you have to put that in context. And unfortunately, some of the militants do not put that in context. There are hundreds of other, thousands actually, of other verses that are not used. So if it is not a violent religion, how come almost every act of violence lately seemed to be perpetrated by Muslims? Because, and this is really the reason here, this is what we need to spend a lot of time studying, because there is a very dangerous, unholy marriage between a religious agenda and a nationalistic agenda. And this particular nationalistic agenda is an incredibly frustrated one. It is frustrated because of this iron fist ruling that I was talking about, and it is also frustrated because of a litany of repeated defeats that creates a lot of humiliation. Okay? Are Muslims really plotting to create a caliphate? Like Khadija was saying, some people say they want to go back to the Khalifat days because these were the good days? I don't think so. If there are maybe four or five people who have this idea, I can tell you that this is not really something that resonates in the Muslim world at all. So the answer is no. Are all Muslims alike? No, they're not. Islam 101, I'm going to skip it, because you can take that. But it is the five pillars, the Shahada, which means to declare there's only one God, the Salah, which is the prayer five times a day, the Zakah, which is giving, and not just giving, by the way. You have to give from that which is most precious to you. Whatever that is that what you give? And then the fasting or the Siyam, and this is, you know, during that month, I mean, you would never see celebrations like you see at that time. And then the last one, of course, is the Hajj. More important, or the pilgrimage. You know, millions of people around. You know what? Even if you are not a Muslim, I think you should do it. Well, wait a minute. So far, Saudi Arabia would not let you, but, you know, maybe some other time. Most important than these four five pillars, actually, are these rules, because that is what your conduct should be. Religious tolerance, like I said, lakum dinakum waliya deen. The golden rule that you find it in any faith, treat others like you want to be treated. It's right there, word for word. Islam is a religion of a community. In other words, and this is really difficult for the Western mind, because as an individual, you don't count. It's the community that counts. What is good for the community is what needs to happen, not what is good for an individual. And then we come to this last word, and I'm going to end up here, the word jihad, that really scares a lot of people. And it really bugs me when I watch some TV. Man, I really wish I would have shown you the pictures of the TV characters that I don't like at all. But, you know, they think that because they know four Arabic words, they cannot even put it in one sentence. They become pundits. I mean, and that they can explain to the world what Islam is and what Islam is not. Here is one surah, like I'm saying. Take not life which Allah hath made sacred except by way of justice and law. Thus does command you that ye may learn wisdom. There is a lot more where this comes from. I mean, you can cherry pick this one instead of one of the other one. Slam by the numbers. I think Ora did a very good job with that. But at least it's about one third of humanity. So if any one of you is thinking that we can solve the problem by annihilating Muslims, think again. Okay, there are at least one third of humanity. Look at this, 58 countries, that is one-third of all of the countries of the United Nations, 58 countries have more than 50% of its population as Muslim. Some mathematicians say it's not going to be the second largest, the first largest by the year 2015. This describes the distribution between Sunnis in the green and Shiites in the blue, but that's a totally different topic, which I would happily... Islam really like a faith... It's like any other faith. It does everything that any other faith does. It's a moral compass. It's a code of conduct. It's a private room where you can really connect with the divine. It's not different than any other. 0 minutes, he says. Okay, so I will stop here, and hopefully I can show slides during the questions and answers. Thank you, and I'm really sorry I took that much time.
Thank you, Dr. Mwafi. Now we'll take questions from the audience. And I will ask you to briefly say who you are, your departmental affiliation, if any, and then ask your question. You may ask a general question, a question to the panel in general, or you may direct your question to either of the two panelists. So the floor is open. Louise.
Yes, my question is for both Dr. Joshar and Dr. Mwafi. Today we were speaking about, in class, in global communication, about religions of the book. And Dr. Joshar mentioned that, of course, the command for jihad, which also Dr. spoke about, was a kind of pep rally in the 8th century, in the early days, so that Muhammad's new followers could feel empowered to defend themselves against the polytheistic peoples that were surrounding them. And it was not, as Dr. Joshar suggested, at the religions of the book, Christianity and Judaism. I was wondering, and didn't get a chance to ask, is there a pecking order whereby the religions of the Far East, of Buddhism, Shintoism, and some of the others, because they don't have a holy book, are they considered maybe less valuable than, or less good, or than Islam, Christianity, and Judaism? That's Joshar, and then
can I guess, is there a pecking order?
Yes. Is there, you said that the fastest way to heaven,
yeah,
is through Islam, and then maybe the second fastest would be Judaism or Christianity.
Yes.
And then, so, and then would Buddhism, Hinduism, and the others be lower than, or slower
actually,
to get to heaven?
Actually, I don't know what, how they approach to Buddhism, Hinduism is interpreted by Ijtihad authorities, by Islamic interpretation authorities. I have not come across that because perhaps this is due to my lack of knowledge. But what I can say is that the God or the gods of Buddhism, Hinduism, and the other religions of the soul are not the same. They are individual religions, mainly emphasizing the individual purity. This doesn't mean that Islam does not emphasize individual purity. We can see its reflection in Sufism, for example. But as far as the God goes, as far as the God is in focus, I do not say that they share the same God. But Islam shares the same God with Judaism and Christianity. That's the point that the answer went in the class.
Right.
Okay. Well, I was supposed to be a discussant also, so maybe I can add a couple of things here in line with that. But firstly, on jihad. In Islam, jihad is conceived and underlined as of three types. The most important jihad is called jihad-e-akbari, which is the jihad of a person to purify one's own moral and live an ethical life. That is seen to be the greatest fight, and it's conceived as a fight, as a struggle. The word means a struggle, not a fight. Second jihad is the umayyad jihad, which is the jihad to do good for the community. So if there are homeless people, you go help. That struggle is obligatory to you. If there's poverty, to help the poor. If there is other problems such as crime, whatever, that's the second. The least of the jihad, the askari, it's called the little jihad, calls on Muslims to fight back when their community is attacked by an aggressor. Only in that condition do you take up arms. So it's very specific. On the point about the Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists and gods and God, in Islam, Allah is the God of all humanity, irrespective of their religions. It is Rabbul Alameen, meaning the God of all universes. As a matter of fact, the word universe is used in plural, saying there are many universes. And Allah is conceived as a God of all. So God, Islamic God, or God in Islam, is the same God. Now, there are interpretations about some Muslim scholars have even thought of Hindus and Buddhists and other religions as being part of humanity to whom God has sent prophets in the past. And many of their, like Buddha, in many views within Islam, there are multiple views, Buddha is seen as a prophet of God, as sent with the good message. So there's no final word on it, but God in Islam is conceived as God of all the people. I saw a hand way there in the back, the man who hired me. I have to respect him. Oh, okay. Maybe from next question on. Maybe you should just come here and answer. Yes, other questions, please? Yes?
I had a question about the women's rights. And you said specifically that the one group refuses the acceptance of any men in the group.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if anything is being done in coalition with males to further the feminist movement in Turkey, because I think that sometimes it's powerful to have someone not in the problem helping with it.
You know, in Turkish Women's Movement and in Turkish Feminist Movement, this is an ongoing debate whether to integrate men into the act, into our activities or not. I have been part of different organizations, and I'm still is. In an organization that is not specifically focusing on women's rights, that is a more international human rights organization, we collaborate with men for women's rights in the Turkish case and all around the world. But, for example, I'm also a part of another platform, more a local platform, that is Ankara Kadın Platform, Ankara Women's Platform. We do not accept men. Not personally, but it's a group decision sort of thing. So this is an ongoing issue. And for example, last year in 8th March demonstration, there was this fierce debate going on whether to let them walk with us or not. Well, for the time being, the agreement goes in this fashion. Though the agreement is reached it was hard to reach this agreement, though, because, you know, not everybody accepts the exclusion of men. But let them stay aside, you know. let us be on our own on 8th March. Let us voice women's voices. Başkent Kadın Platform is one of them who try to exclude women, who want to exclude, men from women's rights issues. They want them whenever they need them. They say that if they want to support us, okay, we can ask them when to support us, but not when. We do not let them, or we won't let them to support us whenever they want us. So there is this nuance there. So they do not reject all at all. You know, there are some women's organizations or feminist organizations in Turkey who radically reject any kind of men's involvement, but the majority do not reject. Another minority want men in their activities, but the majority say that we would like to ask for help if we want to. That's it. Is that clear? Okay.
Yes.
It's a Muslim organization, yeah.
Are there parallels among the Orthodox Christians in Turkey or other groups?
No, there is none. I have never come across to that. There's no cooperation, in fact. In fact, there's no cooperation among the two, in fact, you know, the Orthodox ones. In fact, there's no organization in Turkey. That speaks in the name of women's rights among the other religions. You know, but what makes Başkent Kadın Platform distinct is that they voice a feminist voice with a religious perspective, and they look at religion from a women's perspective. I have not come across parallel organizations in Turkey among other religious women, among women who belong to other religions.
Yes, actually I did, but in doing some reading some other articles and things. But I've also read about some other interfaith interactions going on there with especially Christian influences there, and people working together to basically get the word out about Muslims are not terrorists, basically getting rid of that stereotype. So I guess this question is for any of you, I guess. Do you see that in the Muslim community for women's rights? Do you see it in general across other countries?
Well, you should feel very privileged, by the way, that you live in Marquette and you are at Northern, because we do have an interfaith community here. And in fact, I'm beginning an interfaith student club, so if you want to be the president, just let me know, okay? The idea of interfaith really crosses a lot of issues, not just women's rights. However, I have to tell you, and, you know, my wife is my witness here, really, I do not judge democracy by anything other than women's rights. women's rights also have a cultural nuance. I would, you know, if I had gotten to the rest of my slides, which I will never do that in my life, I'm not really lamenting that, but I wanted to show, no, really seriously, I've never gotten to the last slide of my talk, ever. I wanted to show you a picture of one of my nieces, who is, actually, if you don't mind, do you mind if I just, really? This is, you know, pictures speak better than words, as you will know. So, here, which says, you know, finally, that's a good thing, right? We really need to learn how to be comfortable with people who dress differently. I mean, not every woman with a hijab is a terrorist, and not every man wearing a dishdasha is a terrorist. It just happened that terrorists do wear dishdashas and hijabs. But here is a picture of my niece in her brother's engagement. Okay? This is her a year later, totally on her own. Her mother is going nuts to have her take that thing off. She said, this is my identity. There is not a strand of DNA of violence in this woman, none. But this is what she wants to wear. So we need, I think maybe you feel more comfortable with me as a Muslim because I dress like this. But if I was dressed differently, in fact, I have a picture of a Taliban fighter in here, you probably would not have felt comfortable. And you know what? I would not really have blamed you at the outset. But this is a message that I really want to give. We have to learn that there are cultural nuances, that not all women who wear hijab are oppressed to wear hijab. Some are not.
Moi, not only that, I'd say she really looks beautiful in this dress.
Oh, she's gorgeous. She's brilliant. Good. Absolutely.
And
brilliant.
May I suggest next time you start your presentation with the last slide first, so so you do justice to all your work that you've done and not ignore some? There's one thing I'd like to add regarding terrorism. Now we have sort of, terrorism is there in everybody's mind, and it's popping up in these discussions too. 2 years ago, not this year, I should do the checking again. If you were to look at the State Department's website on where the numbers of terrorist incidents and region, where do you think in 2004 or 5 the most terrorist incidents happened, according to State Department's own definition? Not the Middle East, not the Islamic world. Latin America, next doors. But is it in focus? Does our media talk about it? So if we talk, you know, when people get their impressions, they get their impressions from the two. So terrorism is not a problem of the Islamic world alone. Its roots are many, and they go into the socioeconomic conditions, finally.
Can I add something?
Sure.
I just want to comment on this, because it is true that terrorism is all over, but there is really some uniqueness to terrorism that is coming from Muslim militants. And in one of the slides, I was trying to explain that. There are some things for Muslims that they absolutely have to do to reform that faith. There are also some things for us we absolutely have to do to help them out. The very first thing that Muslims have to do is to let go of the conspiracy theory, including 9/11 was a Zionist American conspiracy theory. As long as that is still brewing, I really do not know how you can advance. I'm not sure. I wanted to know you. We never had a chance to talk about this when we had lunch, but that's debilitating, debilitating.
Yes.
Isolation of the culture to bring that conspiracy theory where they don't have the interplay between the various educational.
You know, even if it is culture.
Kind of isolated, and so this conspiracy theory kind of thrives.
No, I heard that. I mean, I can tell you a story that would make, you know, you still have hair, Jim, so it will stand out. I mean, really. And I was giving the talk, I shared that story with you, too. About 5 Rotary clubs, and in Egypt, Rotarians are la creme to la creme. I mean, this is really the very well educated, and when I go there, I mean, the easiest path to take is to demonize America, and that does nothing. I took the other way around. I was just putting a mirror in front. This is what you're doing, basically. A brain surgeon in the room stood up, okay, and said, I'm a brain surgeon. When I needed a brain surgeon, I went to Tel Aviv. I did not want to have it in Cairo. On the way out, this guy comes, I mean, he was actually chairing the meeting, took me by the arm like this and said, come here, man, I want to tell you something. He said, you know, when he had that surgery, he put a chip in his head, and that is why he thinks this way. Honestly, I thought he was joking. The tragedy is he was not. He was not joking. So it's not the poor would think that. It's a shackle. If you let go of that, you really would do a lot better.
But what would be the cause of so much widespread conspiracy feeling?
Because, I mean, even when I was still in Egypt, and this is one of the things that I challenged Egyptian with, you have a peace treaty with a country and a war culture in your media. Because you vent all of the anger, you know, you put it in somebody else. You cannot criticize the Egyptian government. Everything in the humiliating defeat of 1967, the first speech we heard from Nasser was, America did that. It was not the Israeli army, it was the Americans who did that.
Well, it depends on the perspective, political perspective one holds. America did have a lot of, and the Western countries in propping up Israel and also we.
Yeah, and I
but
think
that's not the cause.
Yeah.
Your point is well taken. When one does not have an objective analysis of the situation, you're likely to make mistakes. And this, yes, please. You know, come on.
The very answer that I have in my mind, how come people, you know, kind of fall into conspiracy theories? Because, you know, at this stage of civilization, inside a level of progress, I guess people cannot believe what they are doing to each other. That violence. At this stage of civilization, the level of the violence is so high that people cannot believe it. I mean, so they cannot explain it. They cannot go through objective analysis. So that, I think that what that's the source of conspiracy theories all around the world. We have a bunch of them.
At least in my research, most of the conspiracy theories, actually almost all regarding 9/11, actually emerged or emanated in the United States, in the websites in the United States. And Muslim young men were just copying that. So it is not the Muslims conspiring or thinking in a conspiratorial way, but there is a lack, there's a mistrust here of the government, which goes very deep amongst the people. On 9/11, the conspiracy theories came right out of the U.S., right out of Midwest, California and Michigan, not Kabul and Tashkent or Karachi or, you know.
But with all due respect, I heard that on the phone with an Egyptian friend of mine 2 hours after the towers went down. So, I mean, it's not...
Oh, yes, I agree with you. There are all kinds, you know, of people who would, instead of doing good social theory and good analysis, they rely on short-circuited and self-pleasing ways of rendering a situation or so-called and doing so-called analysis. We can take just a couple more questions. There are three hands. I'll take them all. First, I'll start here, then Jim, and then I'll go in the back. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for the information. Jim?
Yeah, I guess I had a question about, a statement about religions with a book. I'm most familiar with Christianity and a little bit about Islam. If you look at the history of Christianity, there's been certain points where there's transformations because they're trying to reconcile the book with other things. So the Middle Ages is trying to reconcile Aristotelian science with the book. For example, in the 17th century trying to reconcile modern science with physical science with the book again, similar kinds of problems. And then finally in the 19th century you have problems of interpreting historical documents and beginning to read the Bible in historical context, as you were saying, you must see certain passages in terms of the political problems of Islam and so forth. We know that in the case of Islam in the Middle Ages, people who I know by their sort of Americanized names or Averroes and Avicenna had ways of trying to interpret Islam so that it could be reconciled with Aristotle. But I wonder, in contemporary Islam, is there anything comparable to this sort of historical reading of the Quran and ways to which now there's historical readings of the Bible? So, for example, in Christianity, John Crossland, who was a Catholic priest and still taught Paul for many years, his way of interpreting the New Testament, Jesus is not exactly the Son of God, this is a different kind of being and so forth. Fairly, I understand, it's fairly radical interpretations relative to fundamentalists. Is there that kind of scholarship in Islam?
I've got 16 names for you here. I never did not get a chance to put them, but the answer is yes. And one of the things we need to do is to know these people. We have to read these people because they are isolated. And they are really courageous. Some of these people get gunned down for what they are writing. We need to give some respect and reach out and know who the reformers are.
To back up Moi here, in Pakistan, there are a number of really very high-grade scholars who are operating within the Islamic jurisprudence and all who are pushing the boundaries of interpretation of Islam, not modifying the text, the sacred text, the Quran, and so on, but just in terms of interpretation. Now, I think the biggest push is the feminist push and the patriarchy and the demolishing of patriarchy. But let me add one thing here. Unlike Christianity, there is no inherent conflict within Islam regarding science. There are two separate... Islam very clearly states these are two separate domains of human endeavor, to know the nature, to investigate nature, do your physics, do your chemistry, do your biology, do all that, and also to investigate the spiritual world, your psychic world, the thing that makes you a human being and makes you scared at times and nervous or so the relationship of the soul, of the person, of the individual to the universe, to powers beyond our control. So that domain is the domain of religion, and the other, the secular. So the secular is contained. Now, I'm not talking about people who speak in the name of Islam and they do not know Islam. They are just fanatics, or they are illiterate people, and they are not. They don't even understand what the philosophy is. So, yeah. In the back.
Most frequent word in the Quran, frequent, is ilm and ulama. Means knowledge, ulama means those who seek knowledge.
Yeah.
The most frequently repeated word.
Yes.
Can I add something?
Sure, please. Come here.
Something too trivial, in fact. When
okay.
Dr. Mawafi mentioned this ulama, but there is this distinction between law and science, that's important. I think that falls into this distinction between what you made, that is universe and this world sort of thing. I think ulama is to do with the law, but there are also...
That's the sharia, that's the jurisprudence.
Yeah.
We'll talk about this, I think, after we're done with the main...
We'd love to disagree, though.
A
question in the back, and yes, please.
Yeah. In Turkey, we have a certain percentage of Shiites, predominantly Muslim, but I think 1% or something among the 99.9% Muslim population is Shia. But I'm not sure about. I have the statistics with me, but not in my memory. The basic fault lines in women's movement today is not between the Sunni and Shia. is not between the Sunnis and Shiites. It's between the Kurdish and Turkish women. It's between the religious and Kemalist secularist women. We do not experience, we have not experienced yet that conflict. But in the Turkish case, being Shiite means something different being Shiite in Iran. I should put this here. You know, we have a certain sect called Alevis. You can either link them to Shiites or to... and they also are affected by what is called Sufism in Islam, another denomination, which can be linked both to Sunni and the Shia traditions. The Alevis, in terms of women's rights, but as a community, both including both men and women, are in real conflict with the Sunni majority. But within Turkish women's movement, you do not feel it or you do not experience it that much.
Well, I guess I'm going to call it a day. I thank our two panelists here, but most of all, I thank you, the audience, for coming and being patient and listening to the two speakers and being so interested in this topic. Thank you all, and have a good night.
Let me just make a couple of announcements before you leave. There are, during the month of February, some other presentations by our visiting scholar from Turkey that may interest you. On February 11th, Dr. Joshar will be speaking with the Student Leader Fellowship Group in the back door room in this building from 5 to 6:30. Her big presentation, however, is on February 20th, Tuesday, February 20th, and it's a presentation on the Turkish women's movement, and it will be in this room, and it will be followed by a reception. And then on February 22nd, there is a gathering of feminist scholars at 5 o'clock in the Whitman Commons rooms that will be dealing with feminism as a paradigm. Watch for the posters and watch for the notices on email. And thank you again for your attention, and we hope you'll come back for more. Good night.
Well, I really like to see that whole program you got. When do you ever present in its entirety?
I don't know.
It's awfully good. I learn a lot just from one little bit.
Maybe we can have another one where I can. If I need an hour. I need an hour. 15 minutes.
Well, an hour, that's not much.
Yeah.
But I certainly would like some, you know, when you're going to have that sometime and it's open to the public.
Thanks.
I thought it was very well presented, what you did, and well illustrated. And,
I'm a little bit of a rebel.
And, you know, I was thinking that about your niece that had the.
Yes.
Well, my aunt was a Roman Catholic nun, and she dressed almost the same way.
Exactly.
Look at all those all over, you know, until 20 years ago. Or,
Why?
No difference.
Don't disrespect
no difference
them
at all. Anyway, it was really good.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Hope to see you Saturday if you can make it.
If I can. Yeah.
I'm new to the university. What all classes do you teach?
I teach any class that has the word nutrition is mine.
I don't know if I'll be in any of those, but all right. I was wondering if there's any classes based more on this topic, though, or anything that would...
I usually give panels. You know that I actually applied for a Fulbright scholarship just like her, and they turned it down because it's not my field.
Got too much of the food.
Yeah, I thought it actually I should be better than those who are. That this is their field.
I actually had a teacher who was kind of the same thing, and she got in the topic, and she was my health teacher at
Community
College up in Ann Arbor. And our first day of class, she said, "If I'm from Iran, this is who I am. I'm going to wear the headdress, and if you have a problem with it, I'm going to give you a write out right now." So many people would, like, giving her grief about her beliefs in class. It was like a conflict of interest, and she'd been in America since.
And that is in Ann Arbor?
Yeah. I was shocked. I was like, the first day of class, I was like, what is going on?
Well, it's in, of course, but it's in.
common history about the Sunni and the Shia.
The Sufis are the mystics.
Yeah.
They literally give up everything. They devote their life to loving God. The thing that she's talking about, this is another very, very small number. They are far, way far.
Okay.
They have so some practices from Hinduism.
Okay. So the Sunni and the Shia are the two major ones, but there are a few other of their minor.
Very minor.
It takes
more
like,
than
not like Christianity where you have lots of different players. Okay.
The Saudis, not just the Saudis, but the religious power in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis. That's from the 1920s. The Wahhabis had a very messianic spot. You have to spread some of the Muslims. And that is not, you will not find that in the other cities. The Shias, the surgeons, it's not that they really want to take over the world, but they want the world to pay them back for centuries of oppression. The Shias, they were under the thumb. Only the Shias, also the leaders of Islam. Any other countries in Shia majority, there would be a Supreme Government. So they just, it's revenge. Actually, there are some Muslims who can tell you the Shias are worse. When Iran and Iraq were fighting, which was a very bloody war for 8 years, each side called the other infidels. It's absolutely bad. You know, the ultimate stupidity of religion. It really becomes a routine. And did the powerful prayer about you woke you up?
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oops,
sorry.
I
think I was up for half.
That's what a lot of people say. Yes, and they are really kind of like a family, even though the ruling party is. They have not really been the arrival of the ruling Saudi, which is why they have been protected themselves from the Saudi future. But that is where Al Qaeda has been.
Yeah.
I mean, have you been to Dubai?
No.
Dubai is, Vegas is nothing. Amazing. Yeah. So Al-Qaeda said, this is sinful, and if you're having fun, you have to be fun. I mean, look at it, like in the Taliban camp, there's no music, not chasing your beer. Show me a word in the Quran that says that.
Not most of the same class as
their own. Of course. But when there is chaos, and you probably notice that in your life, there is chaos. People would not mind the dictators to come. Just anything for a second. I'm not going to be happy, but at least I'm going to work safe. And that's how, you know, the Taliban took over. Yeah, they are waiting for the brutal. Remember the very first prime minister of Iraq?
assisted the transition of the Torah, his name was Alawi. He was another Saddam in the U.S. And he would execute
this whole time,
himself
for a year.
His own
no, this, yeah, this coming
anybody
Saturday,
you know, just not
to really, really guts protesting.
Yeah. He was a punk. You're treated differently than if you're driving a Toyota. You know what I mean? The real.
Yeah, because there'd be places where there'd be sewages running the streets, and then there'd be these houses that would, you know, ride and stuff that
all just yeah, it, within yards, basically.
And
used to be when we just started there, a grenade sold for a quarter, and it was $2 to throw out $150. Now it's $50. I mean, as an American, and $20 you can get with a sniper. You hit it right on the nail. Good man. Samara was the beginning.
Yeah, people don't get recognized. It was.
The picture of that mosque, Samara, you know, when the dome was taken out, but the structure is still kind of. I actually had that screensaver and was asking colleagues, faculty, you know, with PhDs and stuff, if they can recognize them. They had no clue. No clue. Or they would recognize the meaning of to go to the most holy of holy.
Yeah, that was for the Shiites.
Yes. That was their calendar. And you know what the Shiites were saying? The Wahhabis did that. Not just the Saudis, not just the Sunnis. The Wahhabis did that. And that really is a repeat of history from way back. You know how the Shiites and the Sunnis split. The 12 imams, yeah, because you know Muslims do not believe that there is you know, the 12 imams going to come. That's a very Christian thing, so that's the part.
Quick hug, you don't want to interrupt you, just quick hug.
That's
yeah, good job, you did a great job.
Thanks.
They're ignorant. You know, there is huge difference. You're absolutely
yes.
right.
Extremists come in and say, well, better your lives,
yeah.
and we'll do this for you. And if you don't know the difference, that, you know, this could be a bad thing down the road.
Yeah. And then you have clergy who really run away. Support that, you know, your life sucks. There is nothing I can do actually to improve it for you, but I can give you a dignified. You know, that's easy. And then there are people who are looking for the youth that God is telling you to do. I mean, the truth of that is not good. It means not different. You know, the truth is they have the same belief. They have this is, you know, God will do. This is what people do. But is it religion that is making this or doing this? Honestly, I don't think so. This is what people are doing to religion. This is not what religion did to people. This is what people
are doing. Okay. That was very good. Thank you. Your fans want to be
better.
This is Eric's.
Well, what's your name? You have an experience nobody else did. You really are. I mean, that's very, that's a very rich experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I would never take it back.
Yeah. They are huge. I can't.
I can
copy and paste the words. Would that help you?
Yes. Yeah. And you're in the school for about half a mile down. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Only trouble because the images I bring him in, there would be a lot of cases when you would not see the images. These are not the formats that I'm talking about. Here, for example, I had to have a picture of Glenn Beck, but it is not showing, unfortunately. But they're all, you know, there is like about six pictures behind this one.
Yeah.
But, at, you know, the text is.
Yeah, because I know you like